The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, contributing editor to the Trumpet magazine, standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. He is over in Ireland at the moment and will be back, I believe, later this week. Well, it's been quite a few days since we've had a live Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's been a busy start to the week, so we've had a few recorded or best of programs. So I thought I'd focus mostly on one big piece of news that happened over the weekend that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet. That's not actually the United Airlines' novel new policy of beating up their own customers, though that does seem to have attracted perhaps the majority, or at least a good chunk of the discussion these days. It's not something I plan on talking about today. We'll have to see how that new business plan goes for them. But first, a more recent story that ties into what I plan on talking about for the bulk of the show. Yesterday evening, a German football team was attacked, it appears, at the moment, by Muslim terrorists. One of their defenders was injured, and it seems like they were driving, I think it was a Champions League quarterfinal, and while they were driving there, some bombs exploded in the hedges that were hidden there. And police, they recently said they found a letter at the scene saying that the perpetrators carried out the attack in the name of Allah. They said that it was in response to Germany's Tornado aircraft performing reconnaissance missions against the Islamic State. The letter also named German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and it said that in Germany and other crusader nations, that's how they look upon Europe, and that's something we'll come back to later, in Germany and other crusader nations, they're on a death list of the Islamic State. So they're claiming responsibility. The police at the moment, they're also investigating that a path that potentially would see the letter could be fake in order to misdirect the investigation. But it does seem like it's most probably another Islamic terrorist attack, this time in Germany, an attack on a football team. Attacks on high-profile individuals like a football team, perhaps that's a new tactic that we're seeing for groups like the Islamic State. It comes after Friday's attack in Sweden when somebody stole a truck and tried to mow people down, eventually slamming the truck into a department store. An attack that's becoming just increasingly familiar. And once again, it just seems that that's steady almost week after week. We have these news of more and more terrorist attacks hitting Europe. But the main story I want to bring you today is a terrorist attack that did not hit Europe directly, but it was instead in Egypt. Almost 50 Coptic Christians were killed in two separate attacks on Sunday. They were attending Palm Sunday services in northern Egypt. The Atlantic magazine, they wrote that it was the single deadliest day of violence directed against the Middle East's Christians, the Middle East's largest Christian community in decades. So a major attack on Egypt's Coptic Christians. And it's kind of easy to tune a lot of this out think, well, it seems like there are attacks on Christians in Egypt pretty regularly, and it's easy to let this kind of story become just background noise. But those attacks, they're part of an incredibly significant trend, but also this was just a really significant attack, much more dramatic, much bigger than the attacks that we've seen so far on Egypt's Coptic Christians. Really a much more direct attack on Christians in the Middle East, though we've certainly seen a whole series of just violence directed against the Middle East's Christians. It's an attack and this whole story, it has worldwide ramifications, huge worldwide ramifications. The first suicide attack took place in St. George's Church. It was in the city of Tanta, that's about halfway between Cairo and Alexandria. And they had the main doors of that church were sealed to prevent attacks. There have been security measures, strong security measures, put in place in Egypt. There have been previous attacks like this. But those security measures Well, they mitigated one of these attacks, as we'll talk about, but they did not stop these ones, and they certainly did not stop this one on that attack on St. George's Church. The suicide bomber, he entered via a side door, slipped past security, and blew himself up near the altar in the church, killing at least 27 people. And there's actually a recording of when the attack took place, which I'll just play for you now. So just during a song service, or at least while they were singing hymns, and as you can see, it just took a split second to transform that church into a series of chaos and carnage. Then 2 hours later, a second suicide bomber, he approached St. Mark's Cathedral in Alexandria. And you can see on the video images they have there, he's directed into a metal detector at the entrance of the church compound, so some of these security measures, and then he stopped for questioning. At this point, he kind of realizes, okay, I'm about to be caught. And so then he detonates his suicide vest and kills at least 7 people. So in this case, at least he was stopped from entering the cathedral itself, but still an attack that killed a lot of people there, wounded a lot more. Now, this isn't just any old cathedral where this attack took place. It's said to be founded on the site of a church that was founded by Mark, as in the Mark that wrote the Book of Mark. I don't know if there's any proof of that, but it is tradition. It shows the tradition associated with that site where that cathedral was. The Copts, they kind of look at Mark as the founder of Egyptian Christianity, and that he was the first bishop of Alexandria. Again, that's their tradition there. And there were relics, body parts that said to belong to Mark that were kept and buried at that site for many years in Alexandria, they said. It's the historic seat of the Pope of Alexandria, the head of the Coptic Church. So for centuries, for Coptic Christians, this was almost like the Vatican or St. Peter's Basilica, kind of on a smaller scale, but it was the headquarters church of Coptic Christianity in a lot of ways for many years. Now, it also quite a long time ago, the seat of that Coptic Pope moved to Cairo to another St. Mark's Cathedral. This is the largest cathedral in Africa and the Middle East, that one in Cairo. And that is more like the current headquarters of the Coptic Church. But that cathedral in Alexandria, it still has a lot of historic significance for Coptic Christians there. A very important site. And actually, that newer St. Mark's Cathedral, that largest cathedral in Africa, the largest cathedral in the Middle East, it was attacked last December, also, and that was by the Islamic State, just like they've claimed responsibility for this attack too. This time it was a chapel adjoining that cathedral, and the attack killed 25. So this wasn't some small country church that was attacked here. Now, it's tragic whenever people are killed, but it was a very symbolic, very ambitious, very deliberately chosen target. And they've been going for these types of targets repeatedly. But then what makes this even more of a deliberate, a symbolic target, is that the speaker at the St. Mark's Cathedral, while this attack was taking place in Alexandria, was the Pope of the Coptic Christians, Pope Tawadros II. He was giving a message inside that cathedral while the suicide bomber was trying to get in and ultimately blowing himself up outside. This was an attempt to blow up the Coptic Pope. The leader, the at least first among equals, but ultimately the leader of the Coptic Christians. And just think if they had been successful, which they came one metal detector away from being. There are a huge number of Christians being killed in the Middle East, but this would have been one of the most high-profile martyrs since the Middle Ages. A huge event. As I mentioned, it was the Islamic State behind this attack in December, trying to hit that largest cathedral in Africa in the Middle East. And look at what they've done. So they've attacked that biggest cathedral in all of the Middle East, the headquarters church for the Coptic Christians. They've attacked the historic headquarters church of the Coptic Christians, that church in Alexandria, where there's been a cathedral, I mean, we could be quite sure, at least probably coming up to 2,000 years, maybe a little shorter, but coming up to 2,000 years, a cathedral on that site. They attack that. They, in the process, tried to kill the head of the Coptic church, the Coptic Pope. They launched their attack on Palm Sunday at the start of what the Christian world calls Holy Week. They picked a date where there would be lots of people in the church, where a date that would be just full of symbolism. And also, what I didn't mention yet, is that this was a few weeks ahead of Pope Francis's visit to Egypt. He's coming up, he's planning to visit there to meet with the Coptic Pope shortly. So an incredibly symbolic time, an incredibly well thought through attack, all very deliberate. Look at what is happening here. The Islamic State is trying to provoke a holy war. They're going out of their way to do this, to be as provocative, as shocking, as attention grabbing as possible. They're picking the most symbolic, high-profile targets they can. And they're doing it in order to divide Egypt. We'll talk about that in a minute. But they're doing it as well to try and provoke Christians around the world. And they're going to keep trying. Adrian Hilton, he wrote for his Archbishop Cranmer blog. He wrote, make no mistake, this was an attempt on the life of the Pope. Not that Pope, but this one. And he is very vulnerable. If a photographer can snap a priest dashing down the street among his bloodied and dazed congregants, it really wouldn't take much for a Daesh or Islamic State sniper to take a pot shot at the Pope. And they are rather conspicuous targets. Islamists might be politically fractured and theologically fragmented, but they are united in their belief that the Pope must die. This one and that one, along with both the others. There's all these disagreements among these different Islamic sects and groups, but they all want to kill the Pope, and as many popes. It doesn't matter exactly which type of Pope, they'll kill any of them. Daesh or Islamic State might have failed this time, Adrian Hilton writes, but they will surely try again. And here's what Islamic State, an announcement they put out shortly after this attack. They said, Crusaders and their apostate allies should know the bill between us and them is very big, and they will pay it with rivers of blood from their children, God willing. Wait for us, for we will wait for you. So there they're promising to keep lie in wait, to keep trying to carry out these attacks, keep staging them. And then Adrian Hilton just goes on to talk about just how ancient this office of Pope of the Coptic Church is. It's one that they claim to go all the way back to Mark, and that they claim that he founded it. Adrian Hilton, he writes that his jurisdiction was established at the Ecumenical Council of Nicaea in 325. His forebears were present at the Council of Ephesus in 431 and Chalcedon in 451. So they're going for a high-profile target here, and they will keep attacking. We had an article on our website, which I've drawn a lot of this material from, about this attack on Monday by Brent Nachtigall, and he called that holy war is becoming reality in Egypt. And that's a great title. That's exactly right. That's what these Islamic States terrorists want, what they're fighting already, really, a holy war. These attacks in Egypt were part of a holy war. Now, The Atlantic talks about this in an article titled Why ISIS Declared War on Egypt's Christians. And they write, when the ISIS claim of responsibility came within hours of the attacks, it wasn't a surprise. For months, the Islamic State has been accelerating the most important of Iraq-style sectarian tactics in Egypt. In doing so, the group hopes to destabilize the Middle East's most populous country and expand the reach of its by now clearly genocidal project for the region's minorities. Egyptian authorities have thus far been unable to keep up with this escalating threat. This may be largely due to their own incompetence, but it also reflects the increasing sophistication of ISIS assets directed at Egypt. As the group goes on the defensive elsewhere, mainland Egypt is too attractive a potential focus in its jihad to pass up. It appears that the group is now focusing more time, resources, and most importantly, ISIS talent on Egypt, making the situation likely to worsen in the future. Targeting Egypt's Christians is a cold and calculated strategy for the group. ISIS hopes that inflaming sectarian strife in Egypt will be the first step in the country's unraveling. And then it goes through some of the history of attacks on Egypt's Christians in recent times. There were several detonations in 2013 that were ISIS was behind that, and also another group that kind of later merged with Islamic State, pledged allegiance to Islamic State. And, you know, since then, they've not done as well, say, in mainland Egypt as they have in the Sinai, where they've had pretty much free reign. But they want to carry out those same kind of level of attacks now into Egypt. And going this Atlantic piece, it writes, and so although the Palm Sunday attacks were hardly the first time Egypt's Christians were targeted by jihadists, Islamists, or even ordinary Muslim mobs, they represent a sea change in the nature of the threat Egypt's Christians now face, with far-reaching implications for the country as a whole. ISIS has taken the radical step of positing that Christians are to Egypt what Shia are to Iraq, embracing the position that they can be killed indiscriminately and for no reason other than for what they believe. Since the December 2016 Cairo church bombing, the group's supporters online have been forcefully pushing this notion, claiming that the Christians of Egypt were first and foremost polytheists and that due to the treachery they had shown by presumably allying with the West and the Egyptian government, they had to be killed. And he talks about how they've launched this online crowd-funded attempt to get information about Egypt's Christians. They produce wanted posters to urge their supporters to go and try and attack them. In last February, hundreds of Christians in the North Sinai, they had to flee their homes in panic after several Christians were killed by Islamic State terrorists. In this Atlantic piece, they continue that the implementation of this strategy has serious repercussions for Egypt's security and, if successful, for regional stability. For years, members of the group and jihadists in general have struggled with the important question of why jihad has failed in mainland Egypt. The question is fundamental for the group not only because of Egypt's size, but also because it tests whether the jihadi project can succeed in countries not already torn by civil war or hopelessly destabilized. In Egypt, they've had a strong man there in the form of Mubarak and now al-Sisi to kind of prevent what you see, say, in Syria or Iraq where Islamic State has done very well. But they're trying to challenge that. And as all of you that are familiar with this program, and I think we had even a show or two talking about this in the last week or two, we've said for years that Egypt is going to end up allied with Iran. And for a long time, things have been very frosty between those two powers. Now, we don't know exactly how this change is going to come about, but destabilizing Egypt through a group like ISIS, something like that, could be a way, could well play into that, could well lead Egypt into the Iranian allied or Islamist camp, in kind of a similar way that the rise of the Islamic State really helped Iran gain more power in Iraq. It's not that the two are necessarily allied, they're fighting each other, but as the Islamic State helped destabilize Iraq and reduce the power of the Iraqi government and take over a lot of the country, it just allowed Iran to move right in there. And if they destabilize Egypt, there's certainly the potential for exactly the same thing to happen. But this is also part of a separate story as well. This clash that's building between radical Islam in the Middle East and Europe and Christianity in Europe. Tim Stanley over at The Telegraph, he had an article, I guess this was 2 days ago or yesterday, called "There is a War on Christianity. The West Must Stop Being Scared to Say So." And in this column, he writes, "I am angry. Angry that someone could do this, but angry too that it's become so common. According to Open Doors, a charity working with oppressed Christians, each month, 322 Christians are persecuted for their faith, 214 churches and religious properties are destroyed, and there are 772 acts of violence. The horror is not limited, as the far right would have you think, to Muslim countries. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Catholics are fleeing into forests to escape militias targeting church worshippers and properties." But then he does go on to talk about what's happening in a lot of the Muslim world. And he says, "We should call what's going on in some Muslim countries a war on Christianity, because that's what it is. If we refuse to do this to avoid causing offense, we are allowing our worst enemies to police our language." A war on Christianity. That's what's happening throughout the Middle East in many of these Muslim countries. Islamic State and other like-minded groups, they're fighting a war on Christianity. Damian Thompson, he also noted the worldwide nature of this war on Christianity in an article or a blog piece for The Spectator's website called "Egypt's Palm Sunday Massacre is an Attack on Christianity." An attack on Christianity. And he writes, the murderers of Christians in the Middle East, Africa, the Indian subcontinent, and Europe are divided by sectarian squabbles over Islamic hegemony. They disagree, too, about the degree of persecution to which local Christians should be subjected. But the impulse to wipe them from the face of the earth is growing stronger. And Muslim fanatics are delighted that the extinction of Christianity from its ancient heartlands is tantalizingly close to happening. There's a holy war being waged on Christians across the Middle East. And as these quotes bring out, not everybody on the Muslim side waging this war agrees with everybody else, but they agree on the target. And here's Damian Thompson in a Spectator podcast back in December, detailing exactly what's happening here and giving an update of just how this war on Christianity went in 2016. Because as he brings out, it's a war that doesn't make a huge number of headlines right now.
Advent in Egypt began with 25 Coptic Christians killed by a suicide bomber on December the 11th, in a year when, very briefly, the West noticed the murder of Christians around the world. In July, 85-year-old Father Jacques Hamel was killed in the sanctuary of his church in Normandy. That shocked European public opinion, but it can't have shocked Christians elsewhere. An example, in June, northern Nigeria, the pastor's wife, 74-year-old Mrs. Bridget Agbahimi, was beaten to death by a mob of 500 after a rival Muslim shopkeeper accused her of blasphemy. In the same month, in a single day, 460 Christian villagers were murdered by Boko Haram for refusing to convert. Meanwhile, there are just so many countries where attacks on Christians have gone unreported. Bangladesh, Eritrea, and that trendiest of holiday destinations, the Maldives, where if the lady cleaning your chalet preaches the gospel, she'll go to jail. Notice a common thread? But let's add to that list Burma and India, where Buddhist and Hindu extremists, respectively, make life hell for small Christian minorities. "It's the forgotten persecution," said a political journalist friend of mine. I said, "Forgotten by whom?" And he said, "The Foreign Office," which also forgets the demolition of churches in China and, of course, the fact that converting to Christianity in Saudi Arabia is punishable by death by our allies.
So just a bit of a summation of what's been happening just over the past... that was just during 2016. Now, this is I've got some figures that come from just the beginning of 2016, where there was a report that found that Christianity is on course to disappear from Iraq within 5 years. They said disappear unless emergency help is provided at an international level on a massively increased scale. It also found that a huge exodus of Christians from other parts of the Middle East, such as Syria, combined with increasing pressures on Christians in Saudi Arabia and Iran, mean that churches are being silenced and driven out of their ancient biblical heartland. The report also stated that Christians have been targeted by nationalist religious movements, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist, most of which see Christianity increasingly as a foreign colonial import. And in 2002, the number of Christians in Iraq was estimated to be 1 million. So when this is talking about Christianity being on course to disappear from Iraq, it's not talking about just a very small number of Christians being killed or moving out. 1 million, that's a sizable community there. In 2006, that had fallen from 1 million to 700,000. Now it's below 300,000. And again, that was from just the beginning of 2016. That figure could well be much lower by now. His reports estimate that between 60 and 100,000 Christians leave each year. 60 and 100,000. So you can see why that's on course to disappear within 5 years. And the report found that many, if not most, of these Christians who remain want to leave Iraq. Want to leave Iraq. That's just a glimpse at this Middle East-wide, North Africa-wide war on Christianity. This holy war that's been begun. And if you look at the beliefs of ISIS, you can start to get a sense of why they do this. This is absolutely fundamental to just their beliefs, to what they want to achieve. A whole load of their theology, their goals even, and practices revolve around trying to trigger a confrontation with Christian Europe. They want to trigger a confrontation of Christian Europe. So I think The Atlantic and others make good points when they talk about their goals within Egypt and their aims within Egypt, what they hope to accomplish within Egypt by attacking Christians and their efforts to create a sectarian conflict. But it's more than that as well. It's more ambitious than that when you put that alongside with what they're doing in Syria, in Iraq, what they say, what their publications put out, which we'll look at in just a minute. They are attacking Christians because they want a showdown with Christian Europe. That's what's behind what the Islamic State is doing. We'll take a short break now, and when we get back, we'll talk more about exactly what the Islamic State aims to do with these attacks.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe. And it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, contributing editor of the Trumpet magazine. In the first part of the show, we've been talking about the attack on the Coptic cathedral or churches within Egypt that took place on Sunday. This deliberate and targeted attack on some very high-profile and symbolic targets there within Egypt. Now, just before the break, we mentioned this is part of a much wider strategy from the Islamic State of attacking Christians because they want a showdown with Christian Europe. Now, when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, when he first declared a caliphate back in 2014, he said, "Rush, O Muslims, to your state. Yes, it is your state. Rush, because Syria is not for the Syrians and Iraq is not for the Iraqis. The land is for the Muslims, all the Muslims." And then he said, "This is my advice to you. If you hold to it, you will conquer Rome and own the world if Allah wills." And when you look at everything that they've said since then, everything that they put out, this is their top target, Rome. That's the place they talk about most often. That's the symbol of their enemies. We've already read a few quotes from them where they talk about crusaders. Crusaders. They don't talk about New York or London or Berlin. They talk about Rome and crusaders. They see the Catholic Church, they see Christianity as their main rival, as their main enemy. They see that as their path to conquering the world, as we read from that quote, conquer world, Rome, and own the world. They believe that they have to fight with Christianity, European Catholic Christianity, if they want to conquer the world. And that's even why their magazine, their kind of chief vehicle for their propaganda, is called Dabiq. It ties right into their worldview. To quote the magazine's very first issue, it's called that because, according to the Hadith or traditions, the area of Dabiq will play a historic role in the battles leading up to the conquest of Constantinople, then Rome. And that's their vision of end-time events, conquering these two leading centers of Christianity, Constantinople, the kind of main seat of authority for the Orthodox Church, and then Rome, the main seat for the Catholic Church. That magazine's kind of first cover article there talked about how the Romans will land near Dabiq, and they talk about, as well as crusaders, Romans. And they said that an army of Muslims from Medina will conquer these Romans, and it says then they will conquer Constantinople. So they're looking to provoke a conflict with Europe, and everything that they do, they kind of put it forward as being a step on the road to this confrontation with Europe and with these crusading articles. Defeating Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, conquering Syria and large portions of Iraq, all of these things that they're doing, according to what they say, they're merely just the necessary bits of build-up towards this clash with Europe. And so as they move into Egypt, well, of course they're going to launch these attacks on these high-profile Christian targets. They want a crusade. And that's why they're trying to attack Rome. And they're doing a good job of provoking that. We went over all of those statistics just before the break about how they're driving Christianity out of Iraq. And just about this much wider war on Christianity, not just by Islamic State. They reflect the feeling of a lot of people in that area, a lot of different strains of radical Islam, but there's plenty of other radicals that aren't allied with Islamic State that are carrying out these kind of attacks. And we saw just this weekend then the Coptic Pope coming within just a whisker of being murdered by these terrorists. That's the kind of thing you read about in history books. It's a major deal, an attack on the Coptic Pope like that. But think about this. The Islamic State, well, they want a crusade because of their theology, but they also want a crusade because it suits their goals for the Middle East. It helps them and their position in Syria, in Iraq, if they can trigger a crusade. And we already talked about how there are domestic reasons within Egypt why they're going after Christians within Egypt. They want to trigger a clash with Christianity, to boost their own power within Egypt, to bring more people into radicalism and get them involved in fighting for them. But they want to clash with Christianity for these kind of reasons and for Christian Europe and Europe as a whole for these kind of reasons across the whole Middle East as well. They think it will help radicalize Muslims, bring more people behind their cause, bring more different groups behind their cause, unify some of these different groups if they can get Europe to respond forcefully. That's part of their thinking. It's not just a kind of a blind belief in their eschatology and end-time events, though I definitely think that belief is a big part of it, but there are practical reasons as well why they want to trigger a crusade. But think about this. A crusade is also the perfect solution, a crusade of some kind, for the Catholic Church as well, to lead the pushback, to come to the defense of the Middle East's Christians. It would really help them too. They have a whole lot of problems right now, a whole lot of division just within the church, a whole lot of broader problems about, well, what is their place in society? What role does the Catholic Church play in a Europe that has embraced things like homosexual marriage, where abortion is pretty much universally accepted, legal, and tolerated? Those are questions that the Catholic Church is struggling to answer, and these are problems that a crusade, leading some kind of defense of these Christians, can provide a strong answer for. Just to illustrate some of these problems confronting the Catholic Church, Damian Thompson had an article in The Spectator last month. It was one of their cover articles that called "The Plot Against the Pope." And in it, he pointed out the public silence of the cardinals and bishops who, in the early days of his pontificate, missed no opportunity to cheer him on. And in that article, he writes, "The silence is ominous because it comes amid suspicion that influential cardinals are plotting against Francis, motivated not by partisan malice, but by fear that the integrity and authority of the papacy is at stake." Antonio Socci, a leading conservative Vatican watcher, says that cardinals once loyal to Francis are so concerned about a schism. They're worried about a schism within the Catholic Church that they are planning to appeal to him to step down. He predicts that the rebellion will be led by about a dozen moderate cardinals who work in the Curia. Now, Damian Thompson goes on to say that he thinks that scenario is highly unlikely and that he doesn't think Francis is going to be forced to step down. And he writes, "But even if a group of cardinals are determined to elevate Parolin, somebody they could that they're talking about as an alternative pope, what chance do they have of succeeding? It's true that when Pope Benedict resigned, he created an extraordinary precedent that popes can choose to step down, but to nudge an unwilling pope over the edge would be a tall order, even by the standards of today's Vatican skullduggery. However, we remove the fanciful speculation, we are left with a real story. It is no secret in Rome that certain cardinals who voted for Francis are now worried that he is leading the church towards schism and that he must therefore be stopped. There are many more than a dozen of them, and though they may not yet be ready to act upon their concerns, they would like this pontificate to end sooner rather than later." So a lot of division brewing in the church, regardless of exactly what the details of maybe these murky plots. A lot of this division kind of catalyzes about the question of divorce and remarriage. The Catholic Church's teaching is that unless there's an annulment granted and unless there's certain specific circumstances or whether, I guess, a bishop has to be involved, I believe, in the granting of an annulment, but that if a couple just get divorced, that then they can't be remarried, and that remarriage is not recognized by the Catholic Church. And now with divorce becoming much more common, there's a lot that want to, within the Catholic Church, that want to change this and that want to allow divorcees to receive communion, etc. And it's starting to become a very divisive issue within the Catholic Church. And Damian Thompson writes, "A split like this over the meaning of marriage threatens to do to the Catholic Church what the issue of homosexuality has done to the Anglican Communion, creating rifts between liberals and conservatives and dividing the church in the West against the church in the developing world. To a great many in Rome, it looks as if the Pope is single-handedly ripping apart church teachings in defiance of his own hierarchy. It's utterly bizarre. He's been ringing around asking for support on this," says a priest in the Vatican. "Like an American senator lobbying senate, or like an American president lobbying senators?" "Exactly. But he's not getting the answers he wanted. Instead, there's this silence that has not greeted any other papal exhortation I can think of." Why the silence? Damian Thompson continues. "The answer is that the Pope has put cardinals and bishops in an impossible situation. And this has been building as a crisis for the Catholic Church over the last few years. And it does pose, you know, the threat of real schism and division. And it's not an easy one at all to solve. The German bishops are generally the ones that are most in favor of changing church teaching on divorce and remarriage. And the German church is the richest church in Europe. They get money from Catholic taxpayers, and that makes them very rich. And it's hard, very hard for the Pope to try and go against that. And they've already taken some loosely worded comments from the Pope to mean that they can go ahead and make a bunch of these changes. And meanwhile, a lot of other bishops don't like it and are kind of doing the opposite. So it's a real problem for the Catholic Church. At the same time, Christianity as a whole in the West is in crisis. Just spotted this article. This is from the very latest edition of The Spectator, titled The Benedict Option. And this article states, "The collapse of religion in Britain has perhaps been the most striking feature of the last generation. The sheer pace of the decline has been recorded by Damian Thompson in this magazine. Church pews are emptying at a rate of 10,000 people per week. 10,000 people per week. In 1983, some 40% of the population declared itself Anglican. Now, it's 17%. To be a practicing Christian in the West now is to be among, or to belong to, a minority." And that's another major problem for the Catholic Church, and really for all different these Christian denominations. Just this rapidly retreating number of Christians. And this article points to Saint Benedict as the Catholic solution to this. And Benedict founded the Benedictine Order in the 6th century to preserve Catholicism as chaos enveloped the former Roman Empire. And Pope Benedict, he kind of saw this as a solution to the problems facing the Catholic Church with these rising tides of secularism, to kind of form strong communities of Catholic belief that held firm despite all the secularism and just atheism or agnosticism, non-belief surrounding them. And that's part of the reason why he chose Benedict as his kind of pope name. And then meanwhile, you had Pope Francis' name came along, and he saw St. Francis of Assisi as the solution, a church that focuses on the poor, that talks more about the economy and economic injustices and kind of making the Catholic Church relevant to people's lives, doing a lot of what the Catholic Church had done in Latin America, which I think did reinvigorate it and make it more popular. And maybe both of these approaches will be part of what turns the Catholic Church around. But perhaps the real thing that it's missing isn't a new Benedict or a new Francis. Perhaps the real solution is a new Urban. A new Pope Urban. Pope Urban II launched the Crusades. And he did so to conquer Jerusalem. But he also did so because the Catholic Church in Europe was in crisis. And the Crusades were a wonderful solution for him to that crisis. Urban was part of a small chain of really radical reforming popes who wanted to elevate the Catholic Church to new heights. And this push really began in earnest with Pope Gregory the 7th. Reading Roman numerals is, it should be easy, but I guess it's challenging me today. Pope Gregory VII, he came to power 15 years before Urban did. And Pope Gregory, he pushed what historian Paul Johnson called a theory of papal world government. It was basically an idea where the papacy would dismiss and select kings. His goal was basically to unite all of Europe as Christendom, but not in this kind of vague sense of a moral unity or shared historical background, but much more in something that resembled a literal state that had the Pope as its head. That was his view of the world. It's something that we talk about in our booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, something we'll be very happy to send you a free copy of. You can just look on our website, thetrumpet.com, click on the literature tab and navigate around to that booklet. It quotes a whole load of different historians, historical records, writing on a lot of this. It's just amazing how much truth there is out there that you can learn about the Catholic Church just by reading good history. And a lot of it's not even all that hard to find. A lot of it's even in things like the Catholic Encyclopedia. But he was pushing here what amounted to a theory of papal world government. He said that the Catholic Church has never erred, nor will it err. He said that he alone had the authority to appoint and work with bishops, that also he had the authority, though alone, to make new laws, to depose emperors, and absolve subjects from their allegiances. So this idea of, like a papal government, Christendom almost being this country with the Pope as its head. But there was a big problem with that. And that was that much of Europe was already united into a political unit and it already had a head, the emperor. And so Pope Gregory's power grab triggered a showdown between the emperor and the Pope that ultimately ended up pretty damaging to both of them. It caused a crisis within the church. It also caused a lot of problems for the emperor. After Gregory died, Pope Victor took over, he didn't last very long, and soon Pope Urban, one of Gregory's most loyal disciples and followers, became pope. But he took over a divided church, a wounded church, a church that had a major division with the emperor, a church in crisis. He didn't even control the Vatican. Another pope, Clement III, he ruled Rome. He'd been appointed and installed by the emperor, and some in the church went along and were loyal to Clement, and others to Urban. So it was a church in crisis, but it was also a church that still felt that it was the rightful ruler of Europe, that it needed more power and more unity. Well, what was the solution? Here's what J. Rubinstein wrote in his book Armies of Heaven, The First Crusade and Quest for the Apocalypse. Urban II's problems included war with Germany, conflict in France, a rival pope, and Christians in the East under siege. Perhaps a massive pilgrimage, the word crusade had not yet been invented, may solve these problems. And it did. It did a great deal to bring the Catholic Church together, to even bring Europe together. He talks about in that book how before this time, people in France viewed themselves as Normans and Piedmontese, I guess that's in Italy. But anyway, he listed a whole bunch of different tribes that they generally went by. But then after the Crusades and during the Crusades, they started to view themselves all as Franks. It's something that unified the Franks in France, that unified Christianity. In Crusades by Terry Jones and Alan Iria, they write, by summoning an army under the banner of the cross, the Pope was extending the church's mantle over all Christendom. This was the idea at the very heart of the revolutionary papacy. In place of separate local churches at the center of discrete communities, there was to be one overarching church ruled by one overarching Pope. The Crusade was to be its expression and its instrument. And it reinvigorated the Catholic Church. It helped unite this fractured church. He even attempted to use, Pope Urban did, to use the Crusades to unify the Latin and Greek churches, which had been divided. And he had some initial success, but ultimately that was a bridge too far. But overall, his papacy really helped the church recover from its crisis. Encyclopedia Britannica wrote, Pope Urban's pontificate not only led to a further centralization of the Roman Catholic Church, but also the expansion of papal administration. It contributed to the development of the Roman Curia, the administrative body of the papacy, and to the gradual formation of the College of Cardinals. The term Curia Romana first appeared in a bull written by Urban in 1089. And then the Encyclopedia, they concluded, despite many problems that were still unsolved, the victory of medieval reform papacy was secured. It didn't fix everything, but it was a massive solution for the Catholic Church. So we see now the Islamic State, they want to grow in power. They want to unite all of Islam behind them. And their solution to that is to trigger a crusade. Well, the Catholic Church is in crisis. Europe is divided. That's something we've not really talked about, but the European Union is in crisis. They want to unite. The Catholic Church wants a solution to bring unity between Rome and other churches. And internal, they want to bring security within themselves as well. The solution is the crusades. It's pushing back against these attacks from radical Islam in the Middle East. This is where these attacks in Egypt are leading. The Islamic State, they want a crusade, and soon the Catholic Church will realize, well, they have a lot of gain from calling for a crusade as well, from championing the cause of those Christians in Egypt and elsewhere. That's what this is building to. Here's what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry said about these coming crusades in a Key of David program in 2015. It's a bit of a lengthy soundbite, but it's an excellent conclusion, really, to this topic that we've been talking about today.
I'll just read as much of this as I have time for, but here's what the leading terrorist said when they were beheading the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. And this was on a video, and a message signed with blood to the nation of the cross. Well, what is this leading into? It's leading into the clash between the Germany and their allies and Iran and its allies. Notice what he says, all praise to Allah and so on. And today we are on the south of Rome, just across the sea, on the land of Islam, Libya, sending another message. All crusaders, safety for you will be only wishes, especially if you are fighting us all together. Therefore, we will fight you all together. The sea you have hidden Sheikh Osama bin Laden body in, we swear to Allah we will mix it with your blood. After the ISIS leader finishes speaking, his fellow terrorists then commence the beheading of the 21 Egyptian Christians, quote, and we will conquer Rome by Allah's permission, the promise of our prophet, peace be unto him. The militant leader says after his comrade's slaughter of the Christian hostages. Now here we see the Holy Roman Empire, or the King of the North, and the King of the South rising before our eyes, and they're about to clash. And these ISIS terrorists are just telling you the way they're all of the radical Islamists think. That's the way all of them think toward Rome and toward Christians of this world. So we can see this all rising, and they're even talking about the Crusaders. You know about the Crusades, the Catholic Christians that have gone to Jerusalem so many times and had battles and wars with the Arabs. But Germany has a lot of power today. They're the number one, well, in 2006 anyhow, they were the number one exporter in the world. And I think China might have overtaken them. I'm not sure about that. But anyhow, they are a powerful force to deal with. But here they're talking about going and conquering Rome. And Pope Benedict was concerned about radical Islam and knew that there was going to be a confrontation. And I'm telling you, this is all the embryo of Daniel 11 and verse 40. Of the King of the North and the King of the South, and they're about to clash for control of the Middle East and a lot more. That's what it's all about. Libya is still going to be allied with Iran, and I'll show you the scripture in a moment. But they're talking about another crusade, and you know they're right. There is going to be another crusade and a final crusade that's going to absolutely enter right into the second coming of Jesus Christ, and He personally, that is Christ, is going to destroy that last crusade, or the crusaders in that crusade. He is going to do that, and I tell you, that is the best possible news you could ever hear, but it certainly is preceded by an enormous amount of suffering and affliction and many beheadings, frankly. That's what you're going to see a lot more of. But Christ returns at the end of that Daniel 11:40 vision.
So that's what we're seeing building in Egypt. That's what we're seeing building across the Middle East. That's what the Islamic State is trying to bring about. They're trying to provoke a crusade. All we're waiting for now is Europe to respond. And you're already seeing, well, good motivations for them to respond in so many ways. You also see Europe starting to respond and wake up to this threat. And as we've just heard, what we saw in Egypt then, it's part of a chain of events leading to not just a crusade, but the very last crusade. A chain of events ultimately leading to the return of Jesus Christ, who will come and finally put a stop to this whole sequence of crusades. If you want to know more about this subject, we do have an article on the attack in Egypt, as I mentioned, up on our website by Brent Nachtigall about holy war in Egypt. You can go and look at the front page of our website to see that. We also have our booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. Tons of history, tons of prophecy within this booklet. Just a whole load of background on this whole subject that you can go and order from our website, thetrumpet.com. That is about it from me today. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow here at KPCG. That's 101.3 on the FM dial. If you have any comments, questions, anything you want to send in, you can do that at TD at kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening.